This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. Later in the hour, we'll talk about the role abortion could play in the governor's race. We'll hear about the Bengals playoff game this weekend, and you'll meet your new Cincinnati Edition host, Lucy May. But first, the deadline is tomorrow for an Ohio panel to draw legislative district maps. The Ohio Supreme Court rejected the first set of maps, calling them gerrymandered. The panel is meeting again today to try to come up with a plan. Joining me to talk about what's happening are WVXU's senior political analyst, Howard Wilkinson. Hi, Howard.
Hello.
And Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Marianne.
Now, if you have a question or a comment for our guest, call us. The number is 513-419-7100. You also can email talk at WVXU.org. We're on Facebook and Twitter as well. Let's start out with what has happened over the past day or two and what's happening today. Howard, do you want to talk about that? First of all, I guess we should point out the Supreme Court rejected the maps that were turned in, and now this panel is back to the drawing board. What's been happening since then?
Yeah, the panel is the Ohio Redistricting Commission, and it's made up of five Republicans and two Democrats. And they are struggling now to find a map that would more accurately reflect the actual votes that have taken place over the past 10 years in Ohio in legislative races, where it's a split of about 54% Republican, 46% Democratic. The original maps that they filed were nothing like that. What they are going to end up with probably is, and they should, under the instructions of the Ohio Supreme Court, end up with a map that will retain the Republican majorities in the Ohio House and the Ohio Senate, but it will probably end the long period of time that they've had a supermajority, where the Republicans in the legislature basically had a veto-proof majority. Anything that the governor vetoed, they would override automatically. That's not going to be the case anymore, I don't think. Now, they started off by looking at Hamilton County and Franklin County. Hamilton County is a very strange case because right now, after the sessions that they had on Thursday, the Republicans were proposing a map that had, in the Senate races, two Republican districts and one Democratic district in Hamilton County, which is the way it is now. The Democrats proposed two Democratic districts and one Republican district, in other words, picking up a seat. And so they're still at odds on that.
And so that, but they've been meeting and they're meeting again today. But we should point out the deadline to get this done is tomorrow. Chris, you said you watched a little bit yesterday. What were you observing as the interactions were taking place?
You know, one of the things that the Democratic map drawer, he kind of got up and was having a discussion with the commission members, including Governor Mike DeWine. And he basically indicated that the Republican staff members that he is negotiating with or dealing with, we're kind of having a tough time, you know, agreeing that the court's, you know, mandate here is partisan proportionality, meaning that the statewide vote needs to match roughly, you know, what the, you know, the legislative map will need to roughly mirror what the statewide voting preferences of Ohio are. And so, you know, he was told by the Republican members, including the governor, that that's, they understood the court's ruling and that's, you know, that's the direction they should go into. But, you know, this has got to be a, you know, a shock to them because the, you know, Republicans have kind of, you know, beat the Democrats into oblivion in the legislature. They are wholly irrelevant. And now they are at the table as an equal partner and with almost veto power over what goes on. So it's quite the situation up there from what I was able to watch yesterday.
We should go ahead, Howard. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, if they want to provoke a real constitutional crisis in Ohio, then they can ignore the Ohio Supreme Court. They could do that. I don't think that's going to happen based on what I heard in the first session that they had earlier in the week where Mike DeWine made it very clear that he believes that they went too far in the first maps that they did not follow the language of the constitutional amendment. And it seemed to me too that Secretary of State Frank LaRose agreed with him. Sooner or later they're just going to have to face a reality that they're going to have to give on some of these issues. They already have in Hamilton County with the 28th Ohio House District. They cut Democratic incumbent Jessica Miranda out of her own district. She lives in Forest Park. They threw it into a heavily Republican district that goes all the way to the border of Indiana and is represented by a Republican, Cindy Abrams. They at least now have agreed, okay, Forest Park is back into that district, and it would give Miranda an opportunity to run again and stay in the legislature. That's progress.
We should talk about, though, for people that may not be aware, that the way this is set up, voters voted for this, and Republicans, yes, voted for it as much as Democrats. Howard, can you explain what happened?
Well, there was a constitutional amendment on the ballot in 2015 that had set up this system where, you know, we have this redistricting commission. And there were some specific instructions on how to go about it. It was to take some of the partisanship out of the drawing of legislative district lines. Not all of the partisanship, but at least some of them. They at least had to have some minority support for the maps that were drawn under this constitutional amendment, which passed with 70% of the vote. That's a lot of people. And earlier, like in 2012, there was a ballot issue in Ohio that would have taken it completely out of the hands of the legislature, and that didn't pass. But, you know, we've had these rules in place. This is the first test of them, because they can only be tested when there's a new census. And the Ohio Supreme Court, in the constitutional amendment, is designated as the court which will decide whether or not the maps that these folks come up with are constitutional or not.
Well, they clearly said the first ones were not. Can they say no again?
Sure.
Yes.
Chris, do you want to elaborate?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the question here, is like, if the commission got intransigent about doing this, how many times would they go back and forth? You know, I guess I'm reminded of the DeRolf school funding case, where the court repeatedly struck down the school funding system in this state. And it was kind of like, for a lot of years, the legislature said, well, Supreme Court, it's really nice that you have an opinion here. And I kind of wondered whether that would be the case here. But the interesting thing about the hearing yesterday a little bit, and you know, this was predictable. The governor and the Secretary of State indicated before they passed these unconstitutional maps that they thought there were problems with them and that they would, you know, have an issue at the court. And sure enough, they did. I do wonder now whether the court decision gives the governor and the Secretary of State and maybe the auditor as well the political cover they need to basically tell the two Republican lawmakers who drove the train on these unconstitutional maps that, hey, look, we cannot disobey the Supreme Court now. That'll be kind of what's interesting in the next 24 hours before these maps are due, to see if that dynamic actually occurs.
I mean, theoretically, people like DeWine and LaRose could side with the Democrats and pass, you know, have a 4-3 vote that would pass.
Would be interesting. Well, what happens, though? These maps are due tomorrow. What happens if they don't have a map? I mean, they were still talking. Karen Kassler, we had a story on from Karen Kassler at our State House this morning talking about there was still some concern that would they get it done, and they were looking for more public input.
I think that, I mean, they're going to come up with something, but I mean, theoretically, at least the Ohio Supreme Court could hold them all in contempt of the court. You know,
would that include the governor and Yost?
Well, Yost is not on the commission.
Okay.
The three statewide elected officials are the governor, the Secretary of State, and the state auditor, Keith Faber, and the Speaker of the House and the President of the Ohio Senate, and the two designated representatives of the House and Senate on the Democratic side. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, we've never gone down this road before.
Well, what?
So, but it's the one thing, you know, Chris, you mentioned the school funding decision. You're right about that. And that's never been resolved. You know, it's still hanging out there. But the difference is that this is in writing in the Constitution. This is not, you know, this is right. not just some random decision of the Ohio Supreme Court. This is spelled out in the Constitution of the state now.
Watching all of this, though, makes me wonder what's going to happen with the congressional maps, because the Supreme Court also said, try again with those. What's next with that, Chris?
They have some more time to do that. When that ruling came down, I believe, Coward can correct me if I'm wrong, I think they had 30 days to do that. They have a little bit more time because the filing deadlines for Congress are a little bit later, I believe, than the state legislative maps. Now, the court could theoretically come in and say, you haven't complied, you haven't you know, done what we asked you to do, and so maybe they unilaterally will move those dates. I don't think that's beyond the realm of possibility. The congressional map situation is really interesting because of the first congressional district. The court specifically cited Hamilton County as being unlawfully split three times. And so that's going to have a major impact on that race and the incumbent congressman, Congressman Steve Shabbat. So, you know, when they redraw that, theoretically, I think what will happen is that it will have to be a district almost entirely contained within Hamilton County. Hamilton County's population is a little bit too much for just one congressional district. So they'll have to lop off some of it and put it in another congressional district. But no matter which way you cut it, there's a lot of kind of map drawing tools. And I took a spin with one of them over the weekend, just trying to draw the most Republican district I could that was contained in Hamilton County. And even when you do that, it is a district that overwhelmingly voted for President Biden and for Hillary Clinton 4 years back in 2016.
You know, Marianne, one of the things that I don't know, you know, what's going to happen, but Ohio Supreme Court, I would think, would have it in its power to say, okay, if you guys can't do it, we're going to do it. They can hire map drawers too, and have people submit plans to the Ohio Supreme Court, and then they approve one. I don't know that that's the way it's going to be resolved. I would hope not. But, you know, as I said before, we've not been down this road before. This is all new territory.
So if they do draw a map and approve a map that the Democrats disagree with, they still have to appeal to the Supreme Court. Is that correct? It doesn't, the Supreme Court just doesn't jump in. They have to, it has to go. How does that work?
Right. The plaintiffs, or the, that's not exactly the right legal term, but the opponents of the unconstitutional maps would simply go back to court and say they did not, you know, they did not meet the requirements that you laid out. I mean, and they certainly will do that if that's what they feel based on whatever comes out tomorrow.
Yeah, it's spelled out in the constitutional amendment that the Ohio Supreme Court will review whatever plan that the commission or the legislature comes back with.
With the legislative maps, the election's coming up pretty soon. What, the filing deadline is soon, is it not? I mean, what happens if they just keep going back and forth and the filing deadline, you know, comes and goes? Howard?
Well, theoretically, I mean, you know, you can end up having to move to primary. I don't think anybody wants to do that. Frank LaRose certainly doesn't want to do that. He said so the other day. You know, you just have to keep pushing things back. But as Chris pointed out earlier, in the case of the congressional districts, that's a little bit, you know, they have more time. There's 30 days built in for the legislature to come up with a map. And on top of that, 30 days for this redistricting commission to review the legislature's plan and sign off on it. So, you know, you're talking about a filing deadline of like March 4th, which would be 60 days from the May 3rd primary election. That's fine. And it may be that that ends up being the filing deadline for everybody, for all of them.
Now, Howard, you
said...
Go ahead, Chris. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. One thing we should point out is that the new state legislative maps have the potential to scramble a kind of developing race for one of these state house districts in Hamilton County. Right now, there's three candidates running for a seat kind of around the Oakley area, east side of Cincinnati. The drafts of the maps that have come out, both the Democratic and the Republican map, I believe would split those candidates up. Those are include people like Gavi Begtrup, the person who ran for mayor just a year ago, Dunny Isaacson and Colleen Reynolds are all in that race at this point. They may end up with a map where they're not all, you know, in a district together.
That's true. Absolutely.
We just have a short time left, but Howard, I did want to follow up on something you said earlier, and you've said repeatedly this: nothing like this has ever happened before. Why is it happening now? Why is this the time that this is happening?
Well, because it has to. Once a U.S. census is done, the states have obligation to reapportion their legislative districts.
Right, but they do that every 10 years. Why is this particular cycle so difficult?
We've layered on, as of 2015, we layered on this constitutional amendment, which speaks very specifically about how this should be done and what the standards should be.
So that amendment is what's really making the difference.
I'm sorry?
So that amendment is really what's making the difference this time around.
Because we've never had that before. It was just they did whatever they wanted to. The Democrats, when they were in charge, they did whatever they wanted to. The Republicans, when they were in charge, they did whatever they wanted to. But now there are actual rules in place in the Constitution. That's a first.
Mm-hmm. Howard,
we're driving it now.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Howard Wilkinson is WVXU's senior political analyst. We're going to continue our discussion with Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich now, about former Cincinnati Councilman Jeff Pastor's decision to go to trial on corruption charges. Can you give us background? What is Pastor charged with?
So back in 2020, he was among three council members charged by the U.S. Attorney, the federal the Justice Department. They were all charged with similar things, bribery, wire fraud, not mail fraud. And basically, he was accused of taking bribes for official action. And so he, along with Councilman Sittenfeld and Councilwoman Denard, had faced similar charges over those types of issues. And so we have not really heard much from Jeff Pastor in the past year and change that since he's been indicted, which was, I think, in November of 2020. And so, it was interesting this week for him to come out, and actually it was his attorney, Ben Dusing of Kentucky, to come out and say, we're going to trial. We had not heard that before and weren't really sure what to expect in that respect.
Now, we should say that Tamaya Denard took a plea agreement and is serving time. I think she's still serving time.
18 months, yep.
So she is in jail, and P.G. Sittenfeld was very vocal when he was first indicted. We haven't heard a whole lot from him lately. Is that correct?
Yeah, P.G. Sittenfeld has been very, very strident in saying that he is not guilty of these charges, that this is a false allegation, and that he will be going to trial. I mean, he has been unwavering in terms of fighting these charges, and he's attempted to kind of gin up some community support for his position on that. Pastor, on the other hand, like I said, we just haven't heard much from him. Sittenfeld had filed all kinds of motions trying to get the case tossed out, questioning some of the methods used by the FBI in the investigation against him. But we didn't really see much of that at all with Jeff Pastor. So.
Now, his attorney, Ben Dusing, had a lot to say about the witnesses involved in the case. Why does he think going to trial makes sense?
That was a question I asked him. We know that there are two witnesses against Pastor who are developers. One was named by the federal government, Chinadum and Duke Way, and the other has been named by media sources first by WCPO. Christopher Hildebrandt is a second witness. I asked Ducing generally. I didn't ask him specifically, just to be clear about those two, but just generally whether he thinks the witnesses against Pastor are squeaky clean. And he responded that he did not believe they are. Now, he kind of cited media, you know, reports about, you know, that he didn't really, you know, specify again who he was talking about, but he said that we know they're not. And so I think that's one, one way that he might pursue a not guilty, you know, verdict from the jury against Pastor.
So then Pastor had a reaction on Facebook, which I think surprised some people. Do you want to tell us what he said?
Yeah, Facebook's another place where Jeff Pastor was very active and now, you know, lately has not been, but in the last day or two, this week, kind of started to post some more. And there was one post that he deleted. Basically, I'll just read it to you. It said, "I appreciate those who have supported me since the beginning. There are too many to even name, and those who are walking through the valley with me and my family and my close friends. Plainly speaking, my mother didn't raise a hoe, and you do not let folks run over you and the people you love. So here I am." There's kind of an explanation as to why he was going to trial in this case.
But he deleted that.
Yeah, he deleted that. I mean, obviously one of those words, is, pretty pejorative, I suppose. And so maybe he thought that reflected badly, or someone told him that, perhaps that was not good to post before you go to trial.
When is this trial supposed to start?
It's scheduled, I believe, for May 2nd, and Ducing talked a little bit about the length that we should expect. He thought it would last about 2 weeks, which, seems about right.
Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. It's a pivotal moment for abortion law in America, and that could have big implications for Ohio's race for governor. As the U.S. Supreme Court deliberates a decision on a Mississippi law that could limit or even eliminate Roe v. Wade, Ohio lawmakers have been preparing for the day Roe falls. That means Ohio's next governor could play a big role in deciding what, if any, access the state's residents have to abortion. The issue has set off battles over pro-life and pro-choice credentials among both Republican and Democratic candidates for governor. USA Today Network Ohio Bureau State Government reporter Jesse Balmert joins Cincinnati Edition to talk about it. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Certainly glad to have you here. To start out with, let's talk about the role abortion is playing in this governor's race. There's a lot going on. What's your take?
Yeah, it's interesting because the state government regulates a lot of abortion policy, and Ohio's lawmakers, which have largely been controlled by Republicans, have put various restrictions on clinics or requirements over the past years, and largely the Republican governors have signed those bills. Most recently, Governor Mike DeWine signed a bill that would ban abortion as early as 6 weeks gestation, called the Heartbeat Bill. That was caught up in some lawsuits, and so it's currently on hold. But that's the kind of policy that you're seeing from legislators in Columbus. And so whoever is governor next, whether that's Mike DeWine reelected or a different Republican or different Democrat, is going to have a lot of say over how abortion policy proceeds in Ohio.
Well, let's talk first about the current governor, Mike DeWine, who is running for reelection. He does have a primary opponent in Jim Renacci. But as we talk about Governor DeWine, his record shows that he has signed off on all legislation that restricts abortion in the state of Ohio. Yet some people say he hasn't gone far enough. Tell us what the reaction is to his behavior when it comes to abortion.
It's been interesting because I think many Republicans would say that Mike DeWine has been extremely conservative on abortion, has been one of the policies that he has always supported, pro-life policies or anti-abortion access policies. And so it's interesting to see candidates try to run to the right of Mike DeWine on the issue of abortion. But here's where they're coming at it. Mike DeWine appointed former Ohio Department of Health Director Dr. Amy Acton. He also attempted to appoint another Department of Health director who were either Democrats or had previously In the case of the one who didn't actually come here, had volunteered with Planned Parenthood decades and decades ago. And if you're being, you know, a purist on the policy of abortion, those are things that people could find problematic. So I think no organization on the kind of anti-abortion access side has officially endorsed in this race yet, but those are things that they're going to take a look at.
Let's look at the Democratic ticket. Right now we have former Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley running for governor on the Democratic side, running for the Democratic nomination for governor, I should say. And he, through his career, has been both pro-life and pro-choice. Where does he stand now, and how do you think the general public views his stance on abortion?
Yeah, you're right. So right now he is saying that he would support legislation that would provide access to abortion in Ohio. He's saying that those are rights that he would defend. He recently selected a lieutenant governor candidate in Senator Teresa Fetter, who has a longstanding history of defending abortion access rights in Ohio. And I think it's really kind of unimpeachable on that topic, according to, you know, those following it. And so that's where he is now. In the past, he has talked about pro-life stances, has, you know, supported policies that would restrict access to abortion for certain city employees. Now, this was in the early 2000s. So I think there is some hesitation on some groups that support abortion access to support John Cranley as opposed to his competitor, former Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley, who has just been more consistent on this topic.
Well, let's talk about Nan Whaley. Where does she stand? What, you say she's been more consistent. What have you heard? What has she said about this in her time in public life?
Yeah, so Nan Whaley has been supportive of access to abortion in Ohio. There is a clinic in Dayton, much like there's a clinic in the Cincinnati area, that are operating under these variances. And so that makes occasionally state government or state lawmakers try to restrict access to those locations or try to close them. There was even recently a piece of legislation that would make it harder for both the clinics in Cincinnati and Dayton to operate. And so Nan Whaley has been kind of out front defending access to those procedures in Dayton. I think groups like Pro-Choice Ohio or Emily's List are supporting her bid for reasons like that.
But I think you also mentioned that Gloria Steinem is supporting, the longtime female rights activist Gloria Steinem is supporting John Cranley and his running mate.
Correct. And so I think that was an important endorsement for the Cranley campaign. Gloria Steinem is a Toledo native and probably has a long history with Senator Fetter, who is Cranley's running mate. So I imagine that's connected, but getting support from people like that certainly helps.
Let's talk about the running mates. We talked a lot about John Cranley's running mate. Cheryl Stevens is Nan Whaley's running mate. She's from the Cleveland area. What does she bring to the ticket?
So I think Cheryl Stevens, also a former mayor in the Cleveland area, brings kind of diversity to the ticket. So diversity geographically, she is also a Black woman, so brings diversity racially, just different experiences having worked in both city and county government. Neither Stevens nor Nan Whaley has worked in state government, and they're running for a state government position. So that is, I don't know if that's a factor with voters, but, you know, they haven't been there before. And so I think she brings kind of just her experience as a local elected official to the ticket.
We shouldn't leave out John Husted, who is Mike DeWine's running mate. And is there any take on what his take is on abortion? Has that even come into play?
Well, he was the former Speaker of the Ohio House, former Ohio Secretary of State. So I think he's been pretty consistently pro-life, anti-abortion access throughout his career.
Do you think running mates make a difference when it comes to who gets elected?
I think that running mates can hurt you. I'm not sure how much they can help you. I mean, I think thinking back, if your running mate has, you know, tax liens or problems in their past, I think that's something that your opponents will bring up in the race. But does a running mate dramatically increase your ability to be reelected? Probably not. I think it certainly helps if they're a good fundraiser. The merger of the DeWine and John Husted campaigns in 2018 was certainly significant because they both are good at raising money and they were both competitors in that race. So it kind of eliminated some of the back and forth you were going to have to do in that primary. I don't think either of the running mate picks from the Democrats are going to dramatically change the way this race is run.
The primary is still a few months away. Do you think voters are even paying attention yet?
That's a great question. I think they'll certainly be getting more ads, getting closer. I think if you're, you know, an involved Republican or an involved Democrat, you know that there are different candidates in this race. But does the average Ohioan know that we're having a re-election bid for Ohio governor this year? I do think the Ohio Senate race has taken up a lot of the oxygen, replacing Senator Rob Portman, and just the number of candidates on the GOP side has taken a lot of attention away from the governor's race.
Do you think that abortion will be the deciding factor in the governor's race, or do you think other issues will come forward?
I think polling-wise, abortion is rarely individuals' first issue, but I think it's more front of mind this year because of this U.S. Supreme Court decision that is pending. They're looking at a Mississippi law that would ban abortions as early as 15 weeks gestation. And if the U.S. Supreme Court decides to overturn Roe v. Wade and some of its progeny and legal cases, that could have major implications for states, perhaps even sending abortion access back to the states. And so I think it's an issue that voters are going to be focusing on much more than they have in the past. But is that the deciding issue? It, you know, it depends on the voter.
Jesse, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. The Cincinnati Bengals take on the Tennessee Titans in Nashville tomorrow at 4:30 in the afternoon in the AFC Divisional Playoff. It's a big step. For a team that over the past three decades has been known more for losing than winning, joining me to talk about the playoffs, the team, and what we might expect, Inquirer Sports columnist Paul Dougherty. Hi there.
Hi, Marianne. How are you?
Just fine. Thanks so much for being with me today. So you have talked in a couple of your columns, the whole thing about when you first started here, the Bengals were doing so well and it was Super Bowl time and you thought this is how it was always going to be. And then it wasn't for about 30 years. What's it like to cover a winning team again?
Well, we should mention that they did win when Marvin Lewis was here. They just didn't win in the playoffs. But yeah, this takes it back to 1988 for me, which is my first year in town, and there's that similar excitement in town to 1988, which I still say was the most excitement I've ever seen a Cincinnati sports team generate. So I'm not quite sure how to act, but I'm getting reacquainted with success. It's a little odd.
Do you think that it could be just as exciting this time around?
Oh, definitely. You've got a whole generation of fans who've never witnessed this, never experienced this. I mean, a lot of people are younger than 31 years old now when the Bengals last won a playoff game. So, sure, I think the excitement can be even greater than an 88.
What do you think? I've heard a little bit about the injuries, of course. We've heard there are a couple of players with injuries. And are you concerned about that? Do you think that's going to mess with the success when they go to Nashville, play in Nashville?
Maybe a little bit. They're without one of their interior defensive linemen, a guy named Larry Ogunjobi, who is pretty effective not only rushing the quarterback but stopping the run. And Tennessee likes to run the ball, so that could be an issue, but otherwise they're in really good shape. One of their best pass rushers, the the best pass rusher. Trey Hendrickson was in concussion protocol until yesterday. He's out, so he's ready to play. Other than that, they're in good shape and really have been in surprisingly good physical shape all year.
One of the things that you keep saying, and you say you don't know how to say it anymore, is basically Joe Burrow is doing great. Is that everything one would have expected after the injuries last year?
He's a phenomenon. I've been doing this a really long time, and there aren't many quarterbacks ever who have the kind of not only physical ability, talent that he has, but have that certain whatever you want to call it. You want to call it the it factor? I don't know. He inspires other guys to want to play for him. When he's around, they think everything's going to be okay. There's no panic in this team when Joe Burrow is on the field. And there aren't a lot of quarterbacks you can say that about. And they're great quarterbacks. Tom Brady, you could say that about. Patrick Mahomes, the Kansas City quarterback, you can say that about for sure. Aaron Rodgers. These are all elite-level quarterbacks that kind of take the anxiety out of the game. And Joe Burrow, in only his second year, is doing that already.
Somebody else who's paying a lot of attention to all of this that you had a chance to talk with, and I loved reading your story, was your interview with the owner, Mike Brown. And this is pretty reflective for him. As you said in the column, he's 86 years old, and he hasn't seen this in a while. What was your conversation like?
Well, needless to say, Mike and I go way back, good and bad. I've always enjoyed talking with Mike. I like him tremendously as a person. I think he's a good human being. Like most Cincinnati Bengal fans, I've never totally agreed with how he's run the team or understood why he's run it the way he has. And I don't to this day, honestly. Mike expresses a deep desire to win. I mean, he shocked me the other day when he said he wanted his teams to be dominant. The Bengals have been a lot of things over the years. Since I've been here, dominant has not been one of them. And the fascinating thing for me and the frustrating thing for fans is that Mike will profess his desires on the one hand and then behave differently as an owner on the other hand. And that's always been really interesting to me in that I know he wants to win badly. He's never had a coach who's told me anything other than that. But over the years until recently, he hasn't done the things player personnel-wise that would get him even close to being a dominant franchise.
You say in your column, though, that he feels this is a huge burden on him.
Well, sure. I mean, he has his dad's legacy to live up to. He's got a city of fans that don't especially like him and that blame him every time something goes wrong. I would feel a burden, too. I mean, he wants to win, and they haven't. And that troubles him, and I get that.
Do you think the fans will are giving him credit now for how well the team is doing?
No, never.
Not going to happen.
They could win the Super Bowl, and if they don't win by enough, they blame Mike Brown for the score being too close.
So there's no hope that that feeling will turn around?
I don't think so. I've been here 34 years. It hasn't yet.
It was interesting also, Zach Taylor talked about there was no other manager or no other owner, excuse me, that was at every practice. And you even put in your column, he gets to work at 6 a.m. He's 86 years old. I mean, that's a 6 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day. That's a pretty long day.
Yeah, and he's been doing that ever since I've known him. No, it's his purpose in life. You know, and at 86, I think the people who live that long have a purpose, have a reason to get up every morning, and Mike certainly has that. And in that way, he's a remarkable guy.
He had COVID recently. How's he doing?
Doing great. I didn't notice any effects at all. He looked great, sounded great. Was fine. Very minor case.
The team is trying really hard to be good to the fans. Zach Taylor and some of his players were out passing out game balls. Would you have ever expected anything like that? What did that mean to the city?
No, I would not. I would never have expected any. I didn't think I'd ever live long enough to see any coach or owner of a professional sports team handing out game balls to fans. Fans are kind of the most abused segment of society in lots of ways. I think it's great. I think they have concentrated on that for the last several years. They have expanded their social media presence. They're just more aware than they used to be about needing to be good to their fans. It's about time. They're about 20 years too late, but better late than never.
Well, fans may want to go to Nashville. Apparently there's some sort of, have you heard the issue with getting enough Bengals fans at the game?
Well, yeah, they're trying. They're making sure that Titans fans cannot unload their tickets until 24 hours before the game, believing that will make it harder for Bengals fans to get tickets. I mean, I don't know. If you're a Bengal fan, you really want to go. There's a secondary market out there. If you're willing to pay whatever they're asking, you can get in. I just picked up a rental car about an hour ago, and the guy behind the counter said he'd already had five people who wanted cars to drive to Tennessee. So I think there'll be a decent representation of Bengals fans there.
Bengals have never won a playoff game on the road. Is that going to hurt them this time around?
No, I don't think anything that's happened in the past to this franchise has any impact whatsoever on these guys. They only have three players who were alive 31 years ago when they last won a playoff game. So, no, they really don't care about that.
So, of course, everybody locally, all their fans want them to win. In just the few seconds that we have left, if they don't win this time around, what is that going to mean to the fans? Do you think it'll hurt the relationship?
No, not at all. They're playing with house money, Marianne. They've already done with what fans have expected and more, in my opinion. And plus, they've got a lot of young guys who are under relatively cheap contracts, meaning that they have a chance to be back here again next year and the year after that, and maybe even longer. So, no, I think this is gravy for fans right now.
Thanks so much, Paul. I really appreciate it. Paul Dougherty is the Inquirer sports columnist. Thank you so much. As we get to the end of our show, I am here to give up this chair. I want to welcome our brand new host, Lucy May, who'll be sitting here next week. Hi, Lucy.
Hey, Marianne. I can't wait.
Me either, for all kinds of reasons. We are so excited to have you start. For people that may not have followed your career and your history, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you've done over the years?
Okay, well, I was born and raised in Northern Kentucky. I went away to college and worked in different markets for a while, but when baby number one was born more than 25 years ago, I came back to Cincinnati for the free babysitting that my mother offered, and I've made my career here. I've been a reporter for more than 25 years now in the city, and I've worked at newspapers and TV, and now I'm excited to join the WVXU family.
And we are happy to have you in radio, your first time in radio.
Yes.
Tell us why you decided to apply for this job. Why were you interested in becoming the host of Cincinnati Edition?
Well, as you know, Marianne, I've been a big old NPR nerd for a long, long time. I'm a loyal listener to WVXU. I've been a member of the station for many years, and I've been a guest on Cincinnati Edition a number of times over the years. And when I heard Michael Monks was leaving, I was a huge Michael Monks fan. So initially I thought, oh no, Michael's leaving. And then I thought, oh wait, I could maybe apply for that job. That sounds fantastic. So it just seems like a dream job to me. I love this community, love talking to newspapers, love reporting, and I get to do all of that in this job, and nobody has to see what I look like. It sounds fantastic.
You look great. I can attest to that. She looks great. Well, tell us what you hope the show, I mean, each host that's hosted this program, I think, brings a little bit of themselves to the program. Tell us what your interests are, what you'd like the show to be as you begin hosting on Monday.
I have covered a wide range of topics and issues over the past 25 years in Greater Cincinnati. I've covered politics and development and business. And most recently, in my last job, I was covering a lot of social justice issues and poverty and homelessness. And I would just like the show to continue doing a fantastic job exploring all the topics that are mean so much to our listeners, and really talking not only to the decision makers and the policy makers and the people who are on the really researching these things and learning, but also the people on the front lines who are living these experiences and can give us their perspectives and what they think needs to change and to make our fantastic community even better. So I'm just really excited about drawing on my reporting experience and my relationships in the community and meeting new people and learning new things and taking our listeners along for the ride.
Are you ready for the gardening show?
I have to say that since I applied for this job, I have been keeping two plants alive at my house, which is a record. So I feel like I'm as ready as I will ever be.
I like it. I like it. That's a fun show. And of course, in your first week next week, you'll have the political junkie on, Ken Rudin, with Howard Wilkinson. That'll be a fun show for you to do as well. And I do want to warn you, or maybe I should warn your husband. I don't know if you'll be like me, but often when I'm doing interviews, I manage to always bring up something that he did or said, even in an interview I did just yesterday, talking about how we have to clean out stuff in the house and how I need his help because I am very bad about throwing things away. So I would ask that you warn your husband that it may come up, you know.
I will warn him, but I think nothing will surprise him. We've been married for almost 30 years and he's used to my brand of ridiculousness. So I think he's braced for impact.
Any particular interests that you have just fun ones that you might want to talk about on the show?
Well, I am a self-proclaimed crazy cat lady. I have two grown daughters who are very much not spoiled and a small herd of cats, all of whom are spoiled. They've been devastated that I haven't been working from home full time anymore. And I am a huge fan of Fiona the Hippo, Queen of the Queen City. Super excited that my first day is Fiona's birthday. I feel like that's the universe telling me that this is the right place for me to be. And then, of course, I just love the community. My husband and I go walking around all the time. Love the wonderful bakeries we have in the community, and I'm keeping them all in business during the pandemic. So,
well, Lucy, we wish you the best of luck, and we are so happy that you're here.
Oh, thank you. I am really excited.
Lucy May is your new host of Cincinnati Edition. Her very first show will be on Monday. This is Cincinnati Edition, producer for today's program and all of our programs. Selena Reeder, assistant producer Nick Swartzel, technical director is Josh Elstro, and I'm Marianne Zalesnik.